I don't know of a single nation that has enough political capital to put their boys in that line of fire, because it's exactly what they'll be. You know, they'll be perceived as puppets no matter what.
Outstanding is a production of The Washington Stand, where you can find news and commentary from a biblical worldview.
Welcome to Outstanding, where we have critical conversations about the news of the day and the ideas that shape us. Once again, I'm your tour guide, Joseph Backholm, as we continue our effort to take every thought captive to the obedience of Christ, to think Christianly about the world around us, which means thinking soberly, thinking not tribally, trying to find out what is true despite all of the emotion and hysteria around us. And today, we're going to do that in our update around Israel. Now, we know that Israel continues to be in the headlines as they respond to terror threats from Hamas, political pressure not to defend themselves from the global community, and more recently, rockets and drones from Iran. Now, America's longstanding commitment to Israel seems to be in question, is it? That's part of what we'll discuss, because people sympathetic to Hamas continue to, you know, block traffic and demonstrate on America's university campuses. Perhaps even more significantly, President Biden plays for votes of Hamas sympathizers in his quest to win Michigan, while Senate Majority Leader Chuck Schumer called on Israel to replace their prime minister, a very unusual move, Benjamin Netanyahu, during a war. What's the significance of that? Now, much of the moral confusion on this issue in the West seems to be the result of brains completely taken over by the principles of critical theory. Now, what is that? Our moral judgment in critical theory world says that we judge the morality of behavior not based on whether the thing that they did is good or evil, but based on who they are. What's the group identity of the people involved? If they're perceived as part of the oppressed, then even things like mass murder and mass rape are seen somewhat sympathetically. But if they're seen as part of the oppressor group, even acts of self-defense are seen as questionable or even immoral. That's the brave new world we live in. Now, that's not to say there isn't any good news. The unprecedented air attack on Israel from Iran was defeated by a coalition that included Saudi Arabia and Jordan. Does that foreshadow a better future for the Middle East? We'll discuss it all, and joining me today to help us have this conversation is Luke Moon, the executive director of the Philos Project, the new executive director. So, Luke, I think I should start off by just saying congratulations to you on your ascendancy. And thanks for joining me.
Thank you. It's a great pleasure to be with you. It's looking forward to it.
Yeah. Let's start at the beginning. Just give us your assessment. You work a lot in Israel and in the Middle East, and you've studied there, and that's part of your academic journey as well. So as an observer of the Middle East and a friend of Israel, what's your assessment of what's happening there today?
Right. So we are in this moment right now where, like you said, the Biden administration, early on in the post-October 7th, the massacre that happened on that day, the Biden administration was actually very aggressive, very favorable towards Israel, and repeatedly stated over and over again that Israel has a right to defeat, destroy Hamas. And Hamas is one of those terrorist organizations, a cluster of terrorist organizations that is sponsored by Iran. They're in the southern part of Israel in the Gaza Strip. That borders Israel and Egypt. And in the north, there's another terrorist organization called Hezbollah, but those are the two kind of primary ones that Israel is concerned about. And it looks like I was actually pleasantly surprised by such a very strong message. And then they started to waver, started to get a little more concerned. Israel should change its tactics on the ground, be more sensitive, it needs to supply, the people who are launching rockets into Israel. Israel needs to make sure they have food and water. Okay. It's a little strange to me. Like the people who are trying to kill, it's like the Americans, before we ever, got even close to being anywhere inside the borders of Germany, We're like sending, you know, aid packages to the German people and villages in Germany. It's like, I don't think we would have ever done anything like that. And so the administration began to waver, actually began to be very aggressive in pushing Israel to, instead of defeating Hamas, how about negotiate with Hamas? How about we have a ceasefire? And the thing is that Hamas still has 133 hostages. They're not even able to say whether they have 40 that are still alive. And the administration was increasingly putting pressure on Israel instead of Hamas to capitulate, to give in, that kind of thing. And then Iran decided it wanted to, it was going to retaliate for Israel's killing of the general who was responsible for coordinating and planning the October 7th attack. And so they launched last Saturday night 300 rockets into, or not just rockets, but like the, I'll call them aerial vehicles of destruction. Right? Like they were basically, they were drones, kamikaze drones, cruise missiles, ballistic missiles. 99% of those were destroyed. Seven made it through Israel's and the coalition that had been formed to stop them. And so now we're in this moment where the Biden administration is telling Israel, hey, listen, that don't fight back, right? It's, Joseph, it's like getting, you know, if you're wearing a bulletproof vest and some guy, you know, shoots three bullets at you and hits the slugs hit the bulletproof vest, and your buddies are like, hey, listen, man, they, like, don't go at him. Don't go at him. Like, your bulletproof vest, they stopped it. They're fine. Like, you don't need to, you don't need to do anything, right? Like, don't worry about it. Like, it's, yeah. you won, right? You won with the bulletproof vest, but you won. Yeah. So that's where we're at. We're at this moment right now where it's, we're between, like, there's still the good feelings off of the win that happened last week, but we're heading back to that point where we were like, maybe we should make a deal.
Luke, I got a question, because you just mentioned this strange situation that we find ourselves in, where these constant calls for ceasefire are not just calls for ceasefire, but called for because they say we want to get aid to the people of Hamas. Now, war has always been terrible. We recognize war is terrible. There's nobody saying, oh, war is wonderful. We want this to continue as long as possible. But there's always been kind of this understanding that when you're trying to fight evil, and you made the World War II analogy there, like, we didn't like call for a ceasefire to make sure that the people of, you know, Berlin and Hamburg had enough food and water during the, you know, defeat during the war and the response, the Allied response in that war. But that's essentially what is happening right now. What do you attribute that to? Is this a situation where we no longer acknowledge evil as evil, and therefore we got to do what we got to do to eradicate it? Do we not have that category anymore? Therefore, it's just like, oh, well, they're in pain and they're in pain, so let's just try to stop all the pain and sadness.
Yes, kind of. I would say that is, there's two things at play. One is that, yes, we really have, in a lot of cases, lost our ability to call evil evil. And it's, and unfortunately, it's not just within, you know, let's say the Biden administration. It's in the church too, Joseph. Like, it's like there has been, I mean, most of the prayers on the 9th, or I guess it would be the 8th of October, and maybe the following Sunday, that were prayed at Christian churches around the world were, Let's pray for peace in Israel and Gaza or something like that. Not an acknowledgement of, wow, this evil just got perpetrated. Lord, may Hamas be destroyed. Right? Like we don't do that. We don't do that. And I think we don't do it because most pastors have bought into somewhat some form of neo-Anabaptism. like thought and like are just, like evil is a or violence is a really hard thing for a lot of pastors to articulate. There's that. And then I would say Israel is the, and I get this from Douglas Murray, who says Israel is the only country in the world that is expected to fight to a draw every time. It's never allowed to win. I mean, have you heard any politician call for a ceasefire between Ukraine and Russia? I mean, other than the like that small handful that are like really, really, you know, that they've horseshoed around to the point where they're like they're basically on the same. No. Or we're not even, or I'll give you this. You know that Pakistan is ethnically cleansing itself of Afghanis. 2 million of them. 2 million Afghanis are being kicked out of Pakistan. And I haven't heard a word. I haven't heard a word. Stuff going on in Sudan. 11 Christians were killed in Nigeria this last week. No one's calling on them to do a ceasefire. No one's calling them to be nice to the to the people are killing them. It like from like I think to me, some of my thinking about Israel and the Jewish people is actually rooted in the strange, irrational hatred of them, right? Like it's there's a weird expectation put on Jews and Israel that's not put on anybody else, and that to me makes me question things, makes me ask some questions. Maybe it's because, you know, they're the people by which God brought his moral revelation into this world, and the world hates them for it. And so therefore, we'll always come against them every chance we get, right? Because the world loves darkness, and they are, like, even if they don't even acknowledge. I mean, the number of Jews who are trying to hide their Jewishness, I've talked to them. It's a huge number, and yet it seems to not matter, right? So it's a very interesting thing to me.
Yeah. You know, the comparison you make to the Ukraine-Russia conflict is interesting, because there's no question that Ukraine is the victim in that conflict. But there does seem to be a question about whether Israel is the victim in this conflict with Hamas in the Middle East, because many have embraced this idea that they are in fact the occupiers, that they are running an apartheid state. Nobody's accusing Ukraine of running an apartheid state. What's your response to this idea that, well, it's different because Israel is basically running a South African style apartheid state?
Well, that's pure rubbish. I mean, I'm telling you, here's the thing, that Israel is always the scapegoat of whatever is perceived by as the evil of the world, right? So the perception out there is that racism is the worst thing in the whole wide world. Like, you can't, like, to be a racist is, wow. I mean, it's like you and Satan, and that's it, right? Like, it's the worst, absolute. And so what is the worst example in the world of racism? Apartheid South Africa. And so therefore, it's not based upon reality. It's a slander, as far as I'm concerned, to equip Israel with racism. That's at the core of this.
Yeah. And so, Luke, very specifically, how is life different in Israel for those who are not Jewish, for example, than life would have been for Black people in an apartheid South Africa, to kind of make that point?
Right. Well, it was in South Africa, there was white only beaches. That, you know, it's the, you know, the white only, I lived in South Africa for 9 months back when I was a missionary, and I had a friend who's interestingly enough, her sister, was blonde haired, blue eyes. And she was what was called like mixed, like colored. Like, it was just the weird thing of genetics. And her sister could go in the front door of a store, and she had to go around the back door in the same family. But that's apartheid South Africa. It was you know, as you picture the stuff in the South and in the United States in the 50s and 60s before the civil rights movement.
And they couldn't, in my understanding of apartheid South Africa, is you couldn't be elected, which is a big difference in Israel, because there are Arabs, 100%. Right? And they're in the Knesset. And so that's not a situation that exists in an apartheid state. You can own property.
And they're actually, you know, in the Israeli Supreme Court, there is Arabs, there are Arab Muslims, not even like Arab Christians, Arab Muslims. The highest matriculation in Israel education system is from the Arab Christians. They're doing the best education wise. A bunch of the hospitals in Israel are run by Arab Christians or Arabs. The Druze community, which is neither Arab nor Christian nor Muslim, they're their own people. They are doing really well. There's no separate entrance for Arabs into the trains. Everybody's riding together. It's nothing like apartheid South Africa. It doesn't mean there's not discrimination, right? But that's different, right? Like discrimination between people is normal. That happens all over the world. It's not unique to any one people at all. But like government affirmed or promoted or government affirmation of discrimination, if that was happening, that would be wrong, right?
And that's not what happened. By contrast, Luke, I assume there are no Jews living in Gaza, but if there were, what would life be like for them?
It would be impossible. It really would. I mean, they would have to have, you know, massive barbed wire walls around them, like to protect them from the outside, right? I mean, anywhere between 700 to 900 Christians in Gaza out of 2 million people, which I believe makes it the most ethnically homogenous place in the world, right? Like there are, if out of 2 million.
Maybe people, North Korea?
Well, no, but North Korea has Chinese who are like come into like work or like do their, like North Korea is the closest other, right? But even like there's no other group in Gaza other than Arab Muslims.
Yeah.
With the exception of these like 800 Christians. And they're like, you know, they're not doing great.
Yeah. Now, none of this, of course, is to say that the Israeli government is perfect. And I don't think I hear you saying that. And we're not here to say that because, you know, the world is filled with sin and you go through the history of any kind of government or people, and you're gonna find things that shouldn't have been done that were done, and so that's not the point. But when it comes to this idea that, you know, Hamas is just begging for freedom from this oppressor, and they just want to be released into the light of like goodness and tolerance and liberty that the Israeli government is keeping them from, that is a not an accurate depiction of reality. And of course, we know, and it's important in all of these conflicts, and I think this is important in Iran, and it's important in Gaza, that there's a difference between the government and the people. Because very often, and we as Americans can sympathize with the idea that the government is not the people, and it's very possible for people to have as many objections with the government as, you know, in Hamas or in Iran, as we do here in America, right? So that's a thing. But what's the situation in Palestine? Because we know, in Gaza, excuse me, because we know that Hamas was originally elected. Now, there haven't been elections since then. But what's your guess, based on what you know, if there was an election in Palestine today, would they be elected? Do they have the support of the people in Gaza, despite just the terrible conditions that Hamas has created for the people who live there?
Unfortunately, the answer is yes. Not only would they be elected, but they'd be elected by a lot. Here's the real challenge for me as a person who has been involved in this space for a long time. It has a ton of friends, the Palestinian, Arab, all that kind of stuff. And the issue that I'm struggling with, and I don't have a good answer for you, honestly, is that no survey that has been done of Palestinians, whether in the West Bank or in Gaza, since October 7th, has shown less than 75% support for Hamas on October 7th. And often the numbers are higher. We're talking 80 in some, like the highest one I've seen, 87% support for Hamas after October 7th. And when they're asked about the October 7th, the majority support what Hamas did on October 7th. And just so you know what Hamas did on October 7th, I have seared in my mind. I've been there twice, to the places that were massacred by Hamas. The charred remains of a father who has his hands stretched as if he's holding his child, his baby. And it's the charred remains of that man. The baby is not there because the baby burned to ash. But because he was bigger, thicker, all you have is this empty arms. That's in my head. And to have 80% of the people, the population, support that is really hard for me to, like, I don't want to be, you know, I want to, like, support, you know, like you just made the distinction between Hamas and the Palestinians. But I struggle with the 80% that support that. Like, what am I supposed to do with that? I don't have a good answer because I don't, you know, I'm a Christian and I want to see, like, you know, I want to love everybody. And how much of those people are just put, like, they can't answer otherwise because they're afraid. I don't know, but maybe it's the majority are just answered because they're afraid. But maybe it's the majority are answering it because that's what they think. I don't know, but it really causes me a lot of, I think about this a lot. It's probably the thing I think about the most. Like this whole, the whole issue of the death of the innocent people, the women and children who are dying because of the bombs and the buildings falling and all that sort of stuff. I think about that a lot in terms of, but this is supported. This is supported by the majority of the population, the majority. And what I honestly, it's the thing that I think about the most, and I don't have a really good answer for you.
For those of us who see the suffering in Gaza, and we know that it's real because this is war, and there are people who are genuinely innocent who are victims of things way beyond their control, especially when you're talking about kids, right? They are just, they're born into this situation. They are morally innocent, but they are also victims. That's, of course, not a new situation in human experience, tragically, but that's right. What they're experiencing. And but when we think about that, do we assign the responsibility for that to Israel or to the fact that they have a government that creates a situation where other nations, their neighbors, feel like this is the only option that I have is to try to destroy my neighbors in defense of myself. And that reality is further complicated by what you just told us about, is there is overwhelming support among the population for what these terrorist organizations are doing on behalf of the people in Gaza. And that, of course, just gets into the historical conflict, the historical anti-Semitism, hatred of Jews that has existed in this population for thousands and thousands of years. So when it comes to making peace, I mean, of course, we all know that before October 7th, there was a ceasefire, and there had been for a while. Like, who ended the ceasefire? And now whose responsibility is it to ensure a ceasefire, you know, moving forward?
Well, yeah. I mean, here's the thing that, you know, recently there was a lot of talk about what was going on in a particular hospital in Gaza. It starts with an Al-Shifra or something like that. I'm going to mess the name up. But anyways, Israel had gone in. They had... you know, found a bunch of stuff. They had left, and then like a bunch of Hamas and terrorists came back. Over 1,000 actually came back, and actually were using the hospital as headquarters. IDF went to clean them out. They were in the maternity ward. The IDF a group of soldiers came into the maternity ward. There were Hamas terrorists laying on under the beds of the maternity ward, on under the incubator baskets and stuff like that. Women, and the women were holding their babies. And as soon as those guys walked in, they blew themselves up. 57 women and children were killed, along with two IDF soldiers in that. That's what we're up against. That's the reality of what's on the ground. And so when you're asking, like, well, who's responsible for the ceasefire? Like, actually, honestly, I don't want a ceasefire unless Hamas lays down its guns and its arms and lets the hostages go. But this perpetration of evil, I mean, we defeated Japan and Germany to a point where they're like, okay, we lose. We have lost. That's where we need to get to with Hamas, because the Islamists around the world are watching this. And the problem of the world right now is the Islamists, right? Like, there were 5 million Christians in northern Iraq in 1950. There's 125,000 now, it's because of Islamism. Like, it's because of the violent Islam that these people have just been like, I'm out. I'm leaving, and they're gone. Right. So I think the world needs to wake up to this problem of radical Islam or violent Islam. And there needs to be consequences. And one of those consequences is watching the complete and utter destruction of the terrorist organization known as Hamas. It's like, and that, therefore, that would signal to hopefully others, like, we're not messing around. And the Christians got to wake up, because they're coming for us next. And it's happening all over the place.
We know that since October 7th, I mean, even within hours of the attack, there were these calls for, you know, caution, for restraint. I mean, calls for a ceasefire within hours of the original terrorist attacks. And, you know, now, you know, the cities of Chicago and Sacramento passed these resolutions calling for a ceasefire in Israel. And I'm quite sure Benjamin Netanyahu doesn't pay much attention to those things. But despite all that, my sense is that Israel is doing what they feel like they need to do. And, you know, that's what I think they should do. You got to defend yourself and your family. How close are they to actually eradicating? I mean, eradication is probably the wrong word, to defeating Hamas in Gaza to the point that they no longer represent the threat that they have for a long time?
It's actually pretty close. It actually comes down to one small corner of the Gaza Strip. Israel has taken the whole of the Gaza Strip for one small corner. And that little small corner borders the Mediterranean on one side, Egypt on one side, and then the IDF soldiers basically have surrounded it on the other two sides, right? This place is called Rafah, and it's not that big. It's not that big. It happens to be a lot of people there right now. And which is why it's taking a long time for Israel to kind of, they've been waiting to go in, because there's about a million or a million and a half people there, and they're trying to let them out in an organized, coordinated way so that Hamas fighters don't, who are embedded in and dress up like women, actually. They wear the burqa so they can't tell they're men, and they try and sneak past, and they get, you know, so it's that kind of thing. But that's where the leadership of Hamas is. I think that was probably most likely where the remaining hostages are. And so it's not that big. And once Israel decides to go into Rafah, we got about 2 weeks left. They're trying to basically protect the innocent. And you got to think, you know, all those movies, you know, there was a great, you know, I love the latest Magnificent Seven, right? With like, you know, where like, you know, the great outnumbered group is coming into the small town, and they set up all the spikes and all the flaming things and all the gun things, and they got, like, they're ready. Unfortunately, that's basically what Rafah is right now, is that town, right? Because they've known. Booby trapped to the thousandth degree, right? Like, every, like, they probably have watched every Defend the Village movie over the last 20 years and gotten all those little like, oh, we'll dig holes, we'll put spikes to the bottom, we'll, you know, have these flaming things come out. Yeah. And, you know, it's probably where they're at right now. And it's going to be a tough slog.
So it's going to be a tough slog, assuming they're successful there, and to the degree they can just destroy Hamas's leadership and the organization as they understand it right now. You still have this geographic territory where people live. I'm not under the impression that Israel is trying to control it again, though this may have changed that, and you can correct me if I'm wrong. But I want to get your sense of what the future looks like, because, of course, these conflicts are not new. And I referred at the opening of our conversation to the fact that Jordan and Saudi Arabia helped defend Israel from this missile drone attack from Iran. What do you think the future is, assuming Israel is successful here against Hamas? Hamas, as we currently understand them, is defeated. Presumably, there will be vestiges of that and people who will just try to regroup someplace else and continue this millennia-long war. But what do you think the future is for Israel, for this region of the world?
I think so. There's three options on the table, and they're all bad, right? So option one is that the Palestinian Authority, which is the group that's the governing authority in the West Bank or Judea and Samaria, they come in and they kind of are the guys in charge of Gaza. Second idea is a multinational force that comes in and is the group that is establishes order, et cetera, and they're kind of they're backing it. The problem with them is like I don't know of a single nation that has enough political capital to put their boys in that line of fire, because it's exactly what they'll be. You know, they'll be perceived as puppets no matter what. And nor do they have the political will internally. And then, you know, the third option is Israel occupies for a while. And, you know, it just becomes like what's going on in Judea and Samaria. And Israel really has stated this publicly and privately that they do not want to occupy Gaza. The problem is that I don't think Israel has a choice, honestly. I mean, Joseph, we are still occupying Japan and Germany, so you know. We are. I mean, we don't call it that.
We have a
but
presence,
that's what
yes.
we are. Like,
we're not governing them.
We aren't governing them, but we did for a while. Actually, we set up governments. We like reorganized. We expect like we put together a whole infrastructure, and like left a bunch of soldiers there, they're still there. Literally, we have bases in Japan, and we left them there because we're like we don't trust these people, and you know, and they became our friends. So it's like my hope is that that's the direction it goes.
Yeah.
I'm not so optimistic, but. Israel doesn't want it. Israel isn't going to get a choice. They're going to have
Yeah. There's a lot there because, I mean, with respect to World War II and our occupation and now the fact that they're allies, we actually see Japan rearming right now for the first time because of China and the threat.
But we had to let them do that, right?
And we are because we trust them, right?
Yeah, exactly. Exactly.
But I also think there's an interesting, I mean, there's a whole nother show that I actually hope to do sometime on the difference between Japan and a place like Iraq or Afghanistan. And why is it that we could, quote unquote, export democracy? And it seems to have worked quite well in Japan. And they have become a free, prosperous country that has a real recognition of human rights. And then you have other parts of the world where, you know, we go and we occupy and that is not the result. And I think there's a lot of worldview analysis that needs to be understood there. We don't have time to get into that today, but right. It's like, what does a culture comprised of that makes certain things possible and certain things impossible. And we as Americans, we kind of just assume that as soon as we give people a taste of freedom, then it's just going to be beautiful and prosperous everywhere as soon as we get rid of the despots. And that clearly is not the case universally. But Luke, as we wrap up our conversation here, I want to talk a little bit about just kind of the American position again with respect to Israel. As we are recording this, there's conversations in Congress about kind of trying to do Taiwan aid, Ukraine aid, Israel aid all together. Apparently, we're going to separate that stuff now from, you know, immigration policy that was kind of been entwined in that politically here for a long time. We know that Biden is trying to run for election. I framed it at the beginning of the show as he needs the votes of Hamas sympathizers to win Michigan and maybe a couple other states as well. I mean, is that too cynical? But how do you see this playing out in terms of the American support for or lack of support for Israel in this conflict?
Right. I find it very frustrating to put Israel in the same category as Taiwan and Ukraine, mostly because I just think Israel has a different place in, like, for Christians, I think it should have a different place in our understanding of the world. But it is so much of the equation that Biden is making in relation to Israel has to do with the Arab vote in particular. He's very concerned about it. And he seems to have made the calculation that he doesn't need to be that concerned about the Jewish vote in places like Pennsylvania. And I think he's not super wrong in this, that because Fetterman has been so strong as an ally, and he has been, he's one of those, you're like, well, okay, the guy with the hoodie ended up being like the most fearsome, like, advocate for Israel that exists in the Senate. Like, the dude is like fearless. And I'm like, whoa, didn't see that coming. Did not have
that. To that point, parenthetical, do you think perhaps Stroke is kind of a reboot to factory settings for wokeness? Because Fetterman seems to have like come through this like a brand new man.
Yeah, no, I agree. Like, he seems to have no pun intended, woken up, you know, in the right direction. Yeah. No, but I think that is the political calculation, though, is that because Fetterman's so good, he can pick up the Jewish vote in Pennsylvania for Biden, especially if he starts really, you know, campaigning for him and that kind of thing, which we should expect. Whereas Michigan is a different story altogether. Michigan is like those states are pretty close. And especially if the black vote keeps going against Biden and towards Trump, it's going to get much more difficult for him. And I think he's making this the decisions being made about Israel are directly related to what's going on, what's going to happen in November, and the Arab vote in particular, and which is very frustrating to me.
Well, we're going to have to revisit this again because this just isn't going anywhere. We hope and we pray for peace. We know that, you know, just in a broken, sin-filled world, there's not going to be permanent peace anywhere for sure. But it would be nice if, you know, Israel and just the Middle East, for the sake of all the innocents, and we can just all be sympathetic for people who are just trying to support their kids and, you know, have a life and put food on their table and just, you know, leave other people alone, that there's a lot of those folks who just get caught up in these conflicts. And ultimately only Jesus and repaired hearts is going to be able to solve these problems. But Luke, thank you so much for coming on today and for illuminating us about the reality of the very, very difficult, tricky situation. And we will continue to pray for God's will to be done there. So thank you for your time.
Thank you. Thank you for having me. I really appreciate it.
Yeah. And friends, we will revisit this conversation because there's so much more to get to in Israel. But thank you for joining us today. A quick reminder to like and subscribe wherever you found this, because that's the only way you get the next episode, which you will find on the upcoming Tuesday and Friday. And also, if you give us a 5-star review, that helps us make new friends. So we're very grateful every time you do it. If you have any questions, comments, feedback about today's show, email me, outstanding@washingtonstand.com. I'd love to hear from you what your thoughts are and even your suggestions for future programs. It's been my pleasure to be with you today. I look forward to next time. My name is Joseph Backholm, and this has been Outstanding.
Outstanding is a production of The Washington Stand, where you can find news and commentary from a biblical worldview.